Up next on Think, the only thing we like better than taking the moral high ground is letting everybody else know it. We'll spend this hour with philosopher Justin Tosi talking about the nearly universal human desire to be perceived as righteous and how it can tempt us to grandstand, trumpeting our outrage and piling on condemnations of something everybody agrees is bad without doing much to actually change things. We'll talk about how we can use moral talk to actually make ourselves more moral after a short break. That fable about the princess and the pea. This young woman shows up seeking shelter at a prince's castle, claiming to be a princess herself. But she's a mess from traveling through this terrible storm, so the queen decides to test her claim by secretly placing a single dried pea at the bottom of a pile of 20 mattresses and feather beds that she gives the young woman to sleep on. In the morning, the young woman shows up for breakfast complaining she hasn't slept a wink. She's all bruised up from some terrible lump she felt in the bed. So then everybody knows she's the real deal, because only a true princess could be so sensitive to such a tiny irritant. I don't know about you, but my social media feeds are full of people, men and women, young and old, who seem really invested in showing us they are true princesses. But their irritant isn't physical, it's moral. We've entered this bizarre arms race of righteous outrage, where we constantly engage in moral talk to demonstrate how sensitive we are to bad behavior and how committed we are to calling other people out. We can't possibly be sexist or racist or xenophobic ourselves if we are the first to accuse others of those faults, right? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing about grandstanding is that it doesn't necessarily imply hypocrisy. We can be shameless virtue signalers who actually do wish to be on the right side of history. It's just we also wish to be admired for it, and maybe that's a problem. Justin Tosi is assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University. His new book, written with Brandon Warmke, is called Grandstanding: The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. Justin, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Can you start by explaining what grandstanding is and how we end up doing it so often?
Sure. So if you want just a bumper sticker description of the idea, moral grandstanding is the use of moral talk for self-promotion. So these are the people that you might see on your social media feeds who seem to be making all of their moral discussions about themselves, about how strongly they feel about something, about how touched they are by the good and bad things that they see in the world. So what these people are doing when they do this is they're turning moral talk, which is supposed to be a practice aimed at helping other people, they're turning it into something that's more like a personal PR project or a vanity project. They're using moral talk to promote their own reputation. So yes, why do we do that? So human beings are what psychologists like to call moral self-enhancers. So we like to think, pretty much all of us, that we are morally above average. We're better than kind of the average person. We really get what matters in the world. And we want other people to share this impression of us. So we take steps to manage other people's impressions of how good we are. And because of these factors, we end up engaging in moral grandstanding.
I want to get this out of the way right up front. Grandstanding is not a partisan phenomenon, although we seem to be better at recognizing it when it comes from the other side.
That's exactly right, Chris. So thank you for stressing that. So I think it's probably fair to say that if you just look on social media, most of the accusations these days of grandstanding or virtue signaling do tend to come from people on the right aimed at the left. But it's just as you say, it's not a partisan phenomenon, it's a human phenomenon. So those factors I mentioned, those psychological features that human beings tend to have of just thinking well of ourselves and wanting other people to share those positive impressions, those are just kind of the things that make us human. And in fact, with a psychologist named Joshua Grubbs, Brandon Warmke and I have done some empirical research on this now. And what we found is there is no divide among partisans about how likely you are to grandstand. So if you find out that someone is liberal or conservative, Republican or Democrat, it doesn't tell you anything about whether they're likely to engage in moral grandstanding. However, what you do learn is that people who have extreme views are more likely to grandstand. So it's really, the only thing that's political about this phenomenon is that the people who are on like kind of the polar ends of the political spectrum are more likely to engage in grandstanding.
Is there a difference between grandstanding and what's sometimes called virtue signaling?
Great. So I think when people use the term virtue signaling and when they use the term grandstanding, they're often talking about the same thing. They have the same kinds of things in mind. Here's what I would point out as the main difference. We talk about a lot of differences in what these terms most plausibly mean in the book. But I think the main difference is that signaling refers to basically any observable feature of you or of what you say that tells people something about you. So when you talk about virtue signaling, it's just anything that tells other people what your moral features are, what your moral beliefs are, what values you hold. But the thing is, we don't really object to people talking about their moral beliefs, right, or making moral arguments. And in fact, one of the points of our book is that it's really important that people be able to do this effectively, that we be able to have moral discussions in public. So the problem with virtue signaling then as a term is that it throws the baby out with the bathwater. It lumps all of this behavior together when what we really object to and what grandstanding signals out is speech and sort of communicative or expressive behavior that is intended to impress other people. So it's fine for other people to learn about your moral beliefs. When we get into kind of a problem area is when people take steps specifically to show other people how good they are. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about grandstanding.
Well, does it actually work? If I, put out some social media post or stand up in a meeting and talk passionately about something to sort of demonstrate to everybody how good I am, will they think I'm good?
Yeah, well, that depends on a lot of things. So as you mentioned earlier, we're more likely to spot grandstanding or think we spotted grandstanding in people that we disagree with. So grandstanding is probably more likely to work among people who share your values. It's also more likely to work if it's plausible that you mean the things that you say. So one of the examples we give in the book is Harvey Weinstein, one of the few people that we're pretty comfortable saying was engaged in moral grandstanding. Because Harvey Weinstein, after it comes out that there are all these quite credible accusations of sexual misconduct and really nasty behavior involving women. Harvey Weinstein releases the statement saying, I so respect all women and I'm doing this and that. And, I've long stood on the side of women and so on. And it's just not believable because we already know or have very good reason to believe that this is not a good guy. This is not someone who respects women. So there are these, kind of contextual features like this, whether we really believe the person, whether they're the kind of person we want to think well of. So these are the things that need to be in place for grandstanding actually to work. And it's why people get away with grandstanding. The other thing, I guess, that's pretty important here is that grandstanders tend to use indirect speech. So if someone just comes out and says, look, I'm like the most morally saintly person here. That's not going to work, right? You've got to say something a little bit more oblique, like, well, you know, having long stood on the side of the poor, or something, you know, something like this, that's sort of like you're sneaking in a little bit of information about yourself. You're kind of making it about you, but it's not quite so in your face. This is also a thing that's probably pretty necessary to make grandstanding effective.
Okay, but Justin, this is important too, because I think most people would argue that Harvey Weinstein is clearly a hypocrite, but we don't have to be hypocrites to engage in grandstanding.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And another thing that is very important to be clear on. So it's probably easier to detect grandstanding when someone is very clearly engaged in hypocrisy like Harvey Weinstein was. But I think a lot of grandstanders are quite sincere. They mean exactly what they say. They really are trying to express their deeply held moral beliefs. But you can do that and still be grandstanding, right? So there doesn't have to be this conflict between what you say and what you actually believe in order to be grandstanding. All that you have to do in order to grandstand is to be motivated to say the thing that is grandstanding by this desire that other people think well of you. And of course, that's consistent, at least possibly, with saying something that you actually believe.
So people might be wondering about the difference between taking a stand for what we believe in and grandstanding. What is the disappointment test?
So the disappointment test is something that Brandon and I in the book pitch as this way to tell whether you're engaging in grandstanding, or at least a good way of detecting whether you're grandstanding. So what we say is, look, when you're about to make some contribution to public moral discourse, ask yourself, look, if I said this thing and then I later found out nobody cared about me, no one was impressed with me at all, would I be disappointed? Would that make me think, oh, well, why did I bother to say that then? and if the answer is yes, then that should make you think, well, maybe I'm not doing this for the right reason, right? So, I mean, maybe the thing I'm saying is true. Maybe it would do some good. But if I'm saying it because I want people to be impressed with me, then I'm probably... I just am engaged in grandstanding. So the difference between this sort of showing solidarity with the right side or just taking a stand and grandstanding is that you can take a stand, right, without really caring about what people think about you and whether they're impressed with you. But then again, if you do turn out to care too much about whether people are impressed with you, that's when you're grandstanding.
Another concern you have is that grandstanding can be used to humiliate other people. How does that work?
So, one thing that people tend to do when they are trying to impress others with how good they are is they will look for targets. Right, they'll look for, I guess you can call them targets of opportunity. So we call this in the book showcasing. So what people will do is, take a social media pile on. They'll see that someone has violated whatever norm they care about that day, whether it's, using the right term to describe a position or a person or something like that. And they'll just jump on the person who's violated supposedly this important norm, and they'll use them as an opportunity to show other people that they are the right kind of person, they are on the right side of history here. So we say, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong necessarily with blaming other people or holding them accountable, but you should worry if you seem to you know, if someone seems to be heading into public discourse with this goal in mind of finding a target, right? Because the worry then is you won't actually treat other people appropriately because you're just looking for a fight.
My guest is Justin Tosi, assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University and author of Grandstanding, The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. We'll be right back.
That language in front of the press, he gave permission to use that language against his wife, his daughters, women in his community. And I am here to stand up to say that is not acceptable.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was a clip of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez addressing the comments made by Representative Ted Yoho. My guest this hour is Justin Tosi, assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University and author of a book called Grandstanding, The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. All right, Justin, the AOC soundbite that we just heard, I mean, she was responding to very rude things said about her. How exactly does that response fall into the sort of spectrum of grandstanding?
Well, so one thing that Brandon and I point out in the book that I think is really important to stress is that it's really difficult to detect for sure whether someone is grandstanding. So the thing is, you need a lot of background information about that person, about what they're up to, about what they believe. And a lot of this is just not accessible to outside observers. So what we do in the book is we give a field guide to the kinds of things that people do when they grandstand. So they participate in social media or other pile-ons that, that thing. Yeah, exactly. The thing that everyone else has said 100 times. I also think that thing. Or they'll make increasingly strong moral claims to stand out among their peer group as having especially pure moral beliefs. So they'll ramp up or they'll participate in a kind of moral arms race. They'll trump up exotic moral claims. So they'll find and invent new kinds of moral wrongs. Grandstanders also tend to engage in excessive emotional displays, right? So they'll take every opportunity to show that they are truly outraged by whatever the wrong thing it is that other people are upset about today. Finally, they'll engage in kind of really dismissive comments about people who disagree with them. So they'll say, look, if you don't understand what's wrong with this behavior, I don't even know what to say to you, and you're really not even worth engaging with, right? So you're so morally blighted, I can't even imagine where to start. Now, from this clip of AOC that you played, I mean, I guess something that you might kind of seize on as kind of fishy, but whether she's grandstanding is the part that I'm here to say this. It's tempting to look at this and say, there's the tell, right? So she must be grandstanding because she's making it about what she's here to say and what she wants people to believe about her. You can do this and try to, pick apart people's speech and say, that's the sign that they're grandstanding. But I think this is just sort of a mistake because you can't really be sure. And, the thing to keep in mind is even if you think someone is abusing public moral discourse and that they're engaging in grandstanding, the point of talking about moral issues isn't to settle who is and isn't like the most morally pure, right? So if you kind of go around trying to, you know, detect grandstanding and say, you know, you were grandstanding there, now everyone, let's talk about that, right? Then you're kind of playing the grandstander's game, right? You're actually making it even more directly. You're making the public discussion about whether they're a good person. So, you know, if AOC is grandstanding in this case, if we then start, you know, expending all of our public resources and figuring out, like, what really is in AOC's heart here, then, you know, we're making the problem worse, right? So, so, you know, where do you place her on the spectrum? I don't know. So this is why we kind of give this sort of general picture and want to stay out of this this game of positively identifying cases of moral grandstanding.
So you've done something tricky here with this project. I think you lure people in because we want tools for pointing the finger at everyone else who grandstands. And what you're really trying to do is ask us to examine our own behavior.
That's right. Yeah. So it is a bit of a bait and switch there. You're right. Because I know everybody, you know, we want ammunition, right? We want something to throw at the people we don't like in these discussions. But what you say is exactly right. I mean, what Brandon and I are hoping is that people will read this book and they'll stop doing this thing of like, well, how can I spot other grandstanders, right? How can I give these jerks what they deserve, and instead think, well, how can I make this problem better? So this is why, you know, we say, like, you should apply this disappointment test to yourself. Ask yourself, you know, if nobody cared about the thing I'm about to say, and at least as far as like what it says about me, would that bother me? So the point here is to ask yourself, like, am I trying to actually do good with my contributions to these political discussions, or am I just trying to look good? So one thing that, you know, Brandon and I like to say is nobody hears about this project, it seems like, and says, oh my gosh, oh, I feel so like bad. Like,
I do this all the time, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. They think, yeah, I can't stand those people. Mm. So, you know, the hope is that people will take this as a call to do better themselves and not about how to hunt these grandstanders down and eradicate them.
You've observed here that people sometimes pile on to add weight to a position. They're not even entirely sure they hold themselves, but they don't want to miss out on a chance to be seen as kind of with the good guys or their tribe. This strikes me as a key explanation for why, say, Russian influence campaigns can be so dangerous, right? These radical positions on both sides of the political spectrum are put forth by somebody from outside. Americans pile on to show how good they are. Pretty soon we're all endorsing views that may be stronger than our natural ones and suspicious to the point of despising those who appear to be on the other side.
Mm, yeah, that's great. Yeah, so I think that one thing that it is easy to miss is that the pressure to grandstand can be really heavy. And this is exactly, I think you're exactly right. This is why some of these kind of viral campaigns to denounce this or that person are so infectious, because no one wants to be seen as, you know, lacking in courage when it comes to standing up to injustice. And even recently, you know, with some of the things that people have talked about in terms of social injustice, there have been people saying, you know, so-and-so is suspiciously quiet about this issue, right? So when someone says that, they're kind of prodding the target to come out and grandstand, right? To show everyone that, no, indeed, my heart is in the right place on this issue. And you know, thinking about this, this should make us, I think, even more reluctant to heap blame on people for grandstanding, because the cost of doing so, the social pressure to engage in grandstanding can be really strong. So I think it's actually quite understandable. And, you know, when I think about times in the past where I've engaged in grandstanding, I think this is often the reason I did it. I felt like if I don't say something here, people are going to interpret my silence as a sign that I have really bad views, right? So, you know, if everyone is facing this pressure from their friend group or just from people that they respect or people even that they're afraid of socially, it's entirely understandable, I think, that they will then go ahead and engage in some moral grandstanding.
Well, I'm curious about how grandstanding functions within like-minded groups. Talk about the black sheep effect.
Yeah. The black sheep effect sounds a little bit counterintuitive at first, but if you think about it, it makes sense. So what the black sheep effect says is that we tend to think worse of the unreliable or moderate, I guess, members of our group than we do about similar people in other groups. So take, for example, the way Democrats feel or felt about John McCain, at least for much of his political career, and how Republicans felt about John McCain. So Democrats thought, you know, this John McCain guy, he's not so bad, right? He's like one of the good guys on the other team. Like, he's useful to us sometimes, like, very, you know, very reasonable. Now, you know, he runs for president and things change a little bit. But, you know, then by extension, Republicans thought, like, this John McCain guy, what is he doing? Like, who does he think he is? Like, what he needs to get his act together and figure out what side he's on. Right. So the thing is, like, so here's how this effect works. We think of these people who are kind of on the fence as unreliable. We think, like, they're not really in this for the right reasons. Right. They're engaged in this kind of like personal glorification or something like that, rather than being principled. So what does this have to do with grandstanding? Well, none of us wants to be seen as this kind of person. Like, we don't want to be the black sheep. We want people to see us as a reliable member of the group with the right views. So in order to avoid being thought of as like the John McCain of the Republican Party, you know, we engage in grandstanding. We show people that, like, no, like, really, we do have the socially accepted view in this case. And in doing so, we hope to avoid some heat on ourselves. And very often, it probably works.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How does naive cynicism warp what we believe about what other people actually believe?
So naive cynicism is this idea that you tend to project more cynicism onto other people than they actually have. So the worry with grandstanding is that if we start to see people engaged in moral grandstanding, we'll become very broadly cynical about moral talk, right? So if we see, you know, occasionally, you know, just now and then, some people engaged in grandstanding, you know, will think, like, okay, well, this person is just kind of out for themselves here. They're treating morality like this kind of personal vanity project. And, you know, I'm just not going to take them very seriously. But then if, on the other hand, we start to see more and more people doing this, so that we might eventually come to think, like, this is what everyone is doing pretty much all the time, it's very easy to take this jump from, like, just a couple people do it to, like, it's everybody. And then if we make this jump, you know, on the basis of just a little bit more grandstanding among our friend group, then the concern is we will stop taking moral talk seriously in general. Right. So we'll become deeply cynical about the whole project. We'll think that, look, there's no point in even talking about moral and political issues because you're not really hearing people's actual arguments or not any good arguments. You're not hearing about people's actual doubts about their beliefs. You're just hearing, you know, the purest version of the thing that they can think of that won't get them in any trouble, And I think we see this already in a lot of public discussion. People just think, like, what's the point in even talking about this openly, right? Because no one is willing to say what they're really thinking. So the danger that again, of course, is if this really gets out of hand, and it's not just about a couple issues here and there, it's about every moral and political issue, then, I mean, effectively, public moral talk is just useless. There's no point in doing it at all. We should just, I guess, talk to, you know, the two or three people we know who are open-minded, who can have a good faith discussion, and no one's really worried about what it says about their deep moral character. But of course, this is a bad outcome. We need to be able to have open public discussions about these issues.
Is it worth it to try and defend people that we think are relatively innocent who get pounced on by grandstanders? Because we definitely are exposing ourselves to being pounced on. And that's like the kind of fate most of us would do almost anything to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a tough thing to give advice about, because you're exactly right. You know, I mean, we all probably see people getting pounded in these online shaming events. You know, sometimes we know these people and we know that they're getting treatment that they don't deserve, but, you know, then what do you do, right? So, I mean, do you stand up for them? I mean, you can do that, and that may be very brave, but then it's just as you say, you might just become a target of the mob's ire. So I never know what to tell people to do in this case. It seems like it's too much to ask to tell people, you know, you should stand up for what's right and tell these people to grow up and, you know, say that, you know, it's all grandstanding. But, you know, then that's very risky. So, I guess I don't have great advice for people. One size fits all advice for people about that. If you feel like it's your friend and, you know, or someone that you think it is worth taking a principled stand to defend, go ahead and do it. But, you know, that's the risk. This is just how the world is now, unfortunately.
Does grandstanding ever lead to good outcomes and behaviors?
It can. That's right. So in this way, grandstanding is like all kinds of other morally bad behaviors. So take lying. Lying, pretty much everyone agrees, is something that in general you shouldn't do. But we can also all imagine cases where to tell a lie, even if it's not great, even if we think like, well, you know, it's sort of like morally icky to mislead people, to intentionally deceive them. Telling the lie is better than whatever will happen if you tell the truth. So the same thing is true of grandstanding.
My guest is Justin Tosi, assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University, co-author of the new book, Grandstanding, The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Justin Tosi. He's assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University and has a new book out called Grandstanding, The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. Justin, perhaps because of grandstanding, we have arrived at this moment where we're all walking around with our levels of outrage dialed up to 11 all the time. Why is this counterproductive if we want to be moral people in a moral world?
So the thing about outrage is that it's a signal to other people that something is really going wrong and it's time to stand up and pay attention. So when we see other people really angry about something, I think it's natural for us to say, whoa, this is out of the ordinary. you know, that person in particular, I don't normally see get this emotional. I better look into it, right? And probably once I look into it, I'll find something needs to be done, right? I at least need to spread the word to other people, or maybe there's something I can even do more directly in the world to address whatever has got this person really outraged. But outrage is also a signal about the person expressing it. So it says, this person in particular was really set off by whatever it is that they saw, right? So their moral emotions have been activated. So the thing is, you can take this signal about yourself and manipulate it, right? So you can express outrage about things that other people might not regard as that being that big a deal. And then what it says about you is you take that thing really seriously. You have really high standards. You demand great behavior out of other people, whereas other people are willing to, you know, look the other way or tolerate a little bit of racism or a little bit of unjust behavior. So the problem here that you might see coming is that because people know they can impress others using this signal, the signal tends to get degraded, right? So everyone is outraged all the time about everything, right? And if this is how it's going, then we're all going to stop taking notice when other people express outrage. And if we're among the people expressing outrage so freely and so readily, you know, at some point, that emotion tends to get exhausted in you, right? You can no longer muster outrage at the appropriate level when it really is fitting. So there's a bit of a boy cried wolf phenomenon here, right? So, you know, this person's upset every single day about something that's going wrong in the world. And, you know, now today, you know, something else has happened. Like, how can I even tell from this person's reaction whether this is serious, right? I can't, because they're doing the same thing they do every single day, right? So the worry here is that if people are grandstanding by expressing outrage so freely, it stops being useful to us, and we really need it as a tool to help coordinate our, you know, general society level reaction to cases of injustice.
Okay, but as you say, some things truly are outrageous. They deserve to be strongly condemned in hopes of changing things. But, you know, sometimes we use outrage the opposite way. We express some outrage to alleviate our own guilt about not taking action to change things.
That's right. Yeah. So, so there are studies of people who, you know, express outrage about the existence of sweatshops, right? And the fact that goods are made in sweatshops. And perhaps a bit counterintuitively, the people who express this outrage are more likely to buy goods that are made in sweatshops. So, yeah, this is just a case of the thing we're talking about, right? Where people are using a signal that's, you know, it has a certain social utility, right? It alerts us all to a real problem, but they're using it for the wrong reason. Right, they're using it as a tool of self-satisfaction rather than as a tool to effectively produce change in the world. So the more they do this, of course, the less seriously the rest of us take it.
So President Trump has violated a lot of longstanding norms in terms of decorum and decision making and sort of behavior as commander in chief. You know, people may or may not be outraged by that, but it's all very different. What happens when we're so overwhelmed by things that we legitimately find outrageous that it starts to not seem outrageous anymore? And you know, the Overton window moves with regard to what we think is unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder actually sometimes about this with Trump. Like, are things going to go back to normal with some of these things after he's gone? Right. So, yeah, what happens? Well, I mean, what happens is that we kind of lose our moorings, right? So people have a kind of baseline, Right. So they quickly adjust to the way things are. And what sets them off then is seeing something like out of the ordinary. Right. So what makes them outraged is seeing something that's worse than what they're used to, or that other people are unusually angry about. So if people are angry all the time, or if they come to just accept lots of things that are perfect, you know, to them perfectly ordinary, then this is, as you note, a way that norms can change. Right. So the thing that we should worry about with grandstanding then is that if it becomes so you know normal to see people upset, then it's no longer going to be remarkable to see people upset. And you know, if we're constantly having our attention drawn to cases of you know supposedly racist or sexist behavior or something like this, then you know eventually we're just going to think, well, there's just no point, right? So, you know, this is something that people say now about a lot of the popular work being talked about, you know, white fragility and critical race theory. You know, the folks pushing this discourse will say, yeah, look, everyone's just racist. There's nothing we can do about it, really. Nothing will help. Well, I mean, look, the response that normal people are going to have to that is not, well, we should now just like dump everything into addressing this problem that you say we can't do anything about. Their response is going to be, oh, well, so you're saying there's nothing we can do? There's no point. It's perfectly normal. So I guess I'm just not going to do anything. right. So the thing here then to worry about is that, you know, if being outraged or, you know, talking about the existence of some feature of the world just becomes so normal, we won't see it as anything exceptional or remarkable or anything to actually act because of. And so we'll become kind of quietist. We'll just come to accept a lot of things that actually are not normal, that we can do something about and that we ought to do something about.
What happens to moderates in a climate of polarized grandstanding?
Right. So I mentioned earlier that grandstanding can turn into a moral arms race with people taking increasingly extreme positions in order to outdo one another. So the reason they do this is that grandstanding encourages people to level purity tests, right? So if the goal is to stand out as being especially pure, having especially strong beliefs, then people are going to engage in a kind of competition. So the goal for them is not to express the truth about whatever moral issue is being discussed. It's to stand out as the most impressive among their group or among the people talking about that issue. So imagine you're a moderate and you see a discussion like this where people are, you know, starting with the position, you know, the police should have their funding cut. And then it's the police should be defunded. And then, oh, no, all along, what we meant is the police should be abolished. Right. And anyone expressing any dissent about the rising temperature around the discourse on this issue is called a racist or, you know, called a fascist or something like this. You know, I look at something like that and I think this sounds like a discussion I don't want to participate in. So the worry then is that moderates, when they see these moral arms races, will just check out because, you know, there's nothing in it for them to engage. All they're going to get is called names and some of the worst things that you can be called that will lead people to ostracize you. So this is not only bad for the moderates, it's bad for everyone else because you don't then get reasonable challenges to the arguments that are attracting adherents within your group. We need people with more moderate views to at least act as a check on what turns into a runaway train on this race to become the most morally pure.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We do tend to make moral examples of people who have been so devoted to, you know, a single pursuit that they refuse to take no for an answer. You know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Is it a mistake to hold people up as, you know, being precisely what we should all want to be morally because they refused to be diverted from the thing they wanted to do? I mean, there are many, many things we admire about figures like this.
Mm. So I think it's fine to have moral exemplars, and the people you mentioned, I think, are fine examples of people that we should all look up to. The downside to having these celebrated moral figures is that people in present day political disputes will kind of see this as the kind of thing they want to become, not for the reason that these people did something important for the cause of justice, but because they want the adulation, right? They want people to regard them as being among the moral saints. So I don't think that means that we should no longer celebrate people like Martin Luther King or Gandhi. I think they were excellent people, and although you can nitpick and find flaws here and there, I think every reasonable person agrees that they did wonderful things for the human race. But I think it's important to keep in mind the incentives that this sets up for others, right? So there will always be people who are alive now who want to be saints, and. I guess the thing to keep in mind is we want them to be saints because they actually cared about justice and did something for the cause of justice rather than like they really executed their plan to become a saint very well.
So lots of us like getting attention for being moral and good, but lots of us besides that actually genuinely hope to be moral and good and want to think of ourselves this way. If we want to be right and moral, why are we so resistant to new information that ought to cause us to reevaluate our views on the world?
Mm. So I see this issue as actually setting up the opposite expectation. Hmm. I think that our resistance to new information, to challenges to our views, can be explained quite well by the very thing that you mentioned, that is our wanting to be morally good. So the thing about human beings is that we want to belong within our groups. We want to have the respect of our peers. We want to be esteemed by the people who are relevantly like us. So the thing that explains why we would be resistant to new information is that new information can challenge our identities. Right? They can make us feel like, well, actually, maybe my group is not right about this thing, or maybe it's a little bit more complicated. So the more strongly we identify with a group, and the more bound up that group identity is with holding certain moral views, the more likely it is, I think, that we will regard challenges to the ideology or the moral values of that group as a threat. Hmm. So better instead to be dismissive and grandstand about how blighted and how awful the people are who challenge the values of your group.
Justin Tosi is assistant professor of philosophy at Texas Tech University. His new book, written with Brandon Warmke, is called Grandstanding: The Use and Abuse of Moral Talk. Justin, it's been really interesting. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Hey, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciated all your questions.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think or listen anytime on our website where you can also learn about upcoming shows. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.